It is Monday, May the 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, a deadly attack in Indonesia. Is jihadism on the rise there?
There's been an intensification, a dramatic intensification over the last week in Indonesia.
Keeping promises at the White House.
President Trump, in his campaign, said his objective was to put American national interest first. And I think that's been the hallmark of his first year plus in office.
And sending capital to North Korea, plus the sounds of Dionne Warwick. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A family of six launched a suicide attack, several of them on Christians attending Sunday services at three churches in Indonesia's second-largest city of Surabaya, killing at least 13, wounding 40 or more. Officials say the husband drove a car containing explosives, rammed it into the gates of one church. The wife and two daughters were involved in an attack on a second church. And at the third church, two other children drove a motorbike with bombs strapped across their laps. The two daughters were aged 12 and 9, while the other two, thought to be the man's sons, were 18 and 16 years old. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Australian National University scholar Greg Feeley for some insight into all of this.
Well, this is unprecedented, certainly in the history of Indonesian jihadism, to have an entire family martyr itself. And I think the decision made by the two parents that they would involve particularly their young daughters in the bombing of the church, which the mother undertook, so that basically all three would perish at the same time. We've never seen anything like this before, and I'm not aware of any other cases globally quite like this. We've had brothers, adult brothers and the like, that have undertaken suicide bombings together, but not entire families kill themselves in the way that happened on this occasion.
Is there an uptick in jihadism in Indonesia?
Not particularly, in fact. There's certainly quite a few thousand supporters of the Islamic State, of ISIS, in Indonesia, but they have been, until now, very well contained by the Indonesian police. The Indonesian police have a very effective counter-terrorism policing operation, and they have arrested well over 1,000 people in the last 15, 16 years, and successfully prosecuted many of those people for terrorism offences. And almost every day they are uncovering new cells, new operations, arresting people. So they have done remarkably well. But nonetheless, we unfortunately know that they can't catch everyone. And in this particular case, the family seem to have quite successfully evaded detection. And the father was the head of a local branch of a pro-ISIS organisation called JAD, but he had no terrorism convictions. The police knew that he'd been to Syria, but had been deported. He and his family had been there, but they hadn't been able to charge him on it because in Indonesia, being a foreign fighter is not an offence.
President Joko Widodo was quick to visit the scene of the attacks. He said this act is barbaric and beyond the limits of humanity, causing victims among members of society, the police, and even innocent children.
Yes, I think the revulsion that he expressed at the nature of this attack, I think, is shared very widely across Indonesian society. Even very conservative Islamic organisations are coming out and condemning this attack with strong language. The very notion that parents could sacrifice their own children in this way is utterly repugnant to most Indonesians. And so it's hard to imagine that this is anything other than an extremely counterproductive jihadist action by this family. Whether they thought of things in strategic terms, but usually terrorists will try to not kill fellow Muslims, they'll try to kill people who are non-Muslims or people who are working for the state. But in this particular case, to kill your own family members, that's something that most people are utterly repulsed by.
These attacks came just days after Islamist prisoners killed five members of an elite counterterrorism force during a 36-hour standoff at a high-security jail near Jakarta. Any linkage?
There could well be, it appears. One other event to add to that, Victor, is that the chief ideologue for ISIS in Indonesia, an Islamic scholar called Aman Abdurrahman, has been in court for his role in facilitating the previous pro-ISIS terrorist attack in Indonesia, which happened in Jakarta in early 2016. And so there's really a series of events here. He is currently in court. There was the riot and siege at the detention facility that you mentioned that happened last week, which killed five police, and in fact a sixth policeman died in a follow-up attack by another jihadist. And now we have the church bombings in Surabaya. The police raided another terrorist cell in West Java yesterday and they shot dead four jihadists. So there has been an intensification, a dramatic intensification over the last week in Indonesia. I think we'll have to wait to see the ability of the jihadist organisations to continue this level of activity. But nonetheless, it looks like this is going to be a spike, the biggest spike we've seen for many years. You would have to go back to 2009 to find an equivalent level of violence compared to what we've seen this time.
Greg Feely is an associate professor and senior fellow in Indonesian politics in the Department of Political and Social Change at Australian National University's Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. John Bolton is an American diplomat and attorney who serves as the National Security Advisor of the United States. He began his tenure as National Security Advisor on April 9th this year. And he recently sat down with Greta Van Susteren on her VOA program, Plugged In. The former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute was asked to compare and contrast the foreign policy objectives of former Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama with President Trump.
Well, I think President Trump in his campaign said his objective was to put American national interest first, and I think that's been the hallmark of his first year plus in office. He has inherited a lot of problems, Iran, North Korea, the Middle East, that really were either not addressed or were addressed incorrectly in the Obama administration. And that's a big part of his responsibility. The Bush administration, by contrast, came in with this idea that the world's problems had been solved, the Cold War was over, economic growth was the only issue, and then we hit 9/11. So really, his presidency was very different. But I think President Trump's got a series of problems to resolve, and he's systematically working his way through it.
Well, it's sort of interesting, because if you look back historically, like North Korea, for instance, back in the beginning, President Clinton tried to do something, and successive presidents did, and even moving the embassy in Israel, which has been a promise by the U.S. Congress in 1995, President George W. Bush said he was going to do it, President Obama said he was going to do it, and now apparently it is going to be done.
Yeah. Well, this goes to the credibility of the United States, and particularly the President of the United States. So when President Trump says, like every other former successful presidential candidate, I plan to move the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, and then he does it, that's not simply something that has an effect on the conditions in Israel. But it says to world leaders all around the world, when he says he's going to do something, he does. And I think, likewise, his recent decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, which he talked about all the time during the campaign and made clear even after he became president, he thought was a terrible deal. By his withdrawal, he simply carried through on what he's been saying consistently for close to 2 years.
What do you expect? Do you expect Iran to come back to the table and negotiate, or is this a standoff between the United States and Iran?
Oh, I don't think it'll be a standoff. I think inevitably, as U.S. sanctions kick in, it'll have an effect on Europe. I think their trade and investment with Iran will drop as well. And I think Iran then faces a very difficult choice. They'd love to keep the deal going because of the economic benefits, which all pointed in their direction. But those benefits are about to be cut off. The economy's in much more difficult shape. Even after the release of the sanctions, we saw demonstrations all around the country at the end of last year. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult for Iran to sustain this.
What's the position about regime change in Iran?
Well, that's not the objective of the administration. The objective is to prevent them from coming anywhere close to nuclear weapons. And I think as the economic benefits that Obama conferred on Iran in the deal disappear, that's the point where they say, as the North Koreans may well have said, we just can't bear this, where the cost of the nuclear weapons, in effect, is much too great.
What is the reason that the president got out of the Iran deal? I mean, the IAEA said that Iran was in compliance. There was a discussion about whether or not the money from the unfreezed assets, that the money that belonged to Iran that was returned during the Obama administration, that provided a lot of money, and that money has been distributed, and there's a lot of complaints it's distributed to Hezbollah and in Yemen and in Syria to fight Israel. Is that the reason why he got out of the deal?
Well, it's certainly the case, the way Obama negotiated the deal, that front-end benefits went to Iran. And that was one of the fundamental mistakes of it. But at its core, the deal was simply not in America's strategic interest. It did not effectively restrain Iran from continuing to pursue deliverable nuclear weapons. It did not have effective verification mechanisms. We entered the deal without knowing anything other than what our own intelligence had given us on Iran's military program. And the IAEA simply didn't have adequate provisions for inspection. So we know that at the core of the deal was a lie about Iran's military aspirations. And the recent information revealed by Israel only underscores that.
But isn't a deal, number one? And I realize that there's a lie underlined, and that's what Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israeli intelligence came up with. But isn't a deal, and doesn't that somehow inhibit the United States in making a deal with Kim Jong-un in North Korea?
Well, I don't think any deal that's based on fraud is valid. And so I think that undercuts it to begin with. But it's also the case, a president has to look at the strategic interest of the United States. So when George W. Bush withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, it wasn't because Russia was violating it, although it probably was. It was because the world had changed. And I think in the case of the Iran deal, it was never in America's interest, and it wasn't getting any better with age. I actually think it increases the chances of a deal with North Korea, because North Korea will say to itself, we're obviously not going to get a deal so favorable to us as Iran, and if we want any deal at all, it's going to have to be much more on the U.S. terms.
All right, so who made the first gesture, the United States to North Korea to Kim Jong-un, or Kim Jong-un to the United States to having this summit?
Well, you know, as President Trump says, what exactly has he given up so far? The fact is that President Clinton wanted to go to North Korea at the end of his administration. He couldn't quite work it. And other presidents have thought about it as well. We'll see, I think, very quickly. I really think President Trump is clear-eyed about the prospects here. He's optimistic because he'd like to make a deal. But I don't think we're going to get taken in like prior administrations.
John Bolton is the National Security Advisor of the United States, speaking with Greta Van Susteren on her program, Plugged In. You can see more of their interview by going to our website at voanews.com and look for Plugged In on the main page. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Washington would be okay with lifting sanctions on North Korea, a move that could create economic prosperity and that will rival, they say, South Korea. Mr. Pompeo spoke on the program Fox News Sunday.
We can create conditions for real economic prosperity for the North Korean people that will rival that of the South. And that is our expectation. It won't be U.S. taxpayers. It will be American know-how, knowledge, entrepreneurs, and risk takers working alongside the North Korean people to create a robust economy.
We asked RAND Corporation Korea scholar Bruce Bennett what he makes of Mr. Pompeo's comments.
First of all, he was not able to really commit American money to do that. He had to turn to private entrepreneurs. And I think it's quite possible if the economic conditions in North Korea are favorable that entrepreneurs will be prepared to invest. The real question is, can North Korea make those conditions favorable and overcome the corruption that they have internally so that it is a favorable environment?
North Korean state media reported over the weekend the country had scheduled the dismantlement of its nuclear bomb site for later in the month. We asked Mr. Bennett just how significant this might be.
Well, we don't really know. There's a lot of evidence that there was already substantial damage to it after the sixth nuclear test in September last year. But it did appear that there were still a couple of tunnels that might be usable for further nuclear tests. So modestly significant. They could certainly go somewhere else and test if they chose to in the future to break out of any agreement with the U.S., but hopefully they won't do that and they'll stick with the agreement.
And as we've been reporting, President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un have planned a June 12th meeting in Singapore. It would be the first encounter between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader. And what about the significance of Singapore as a venue?
I think Singapore was the right choice. You know, you can't do it in Pyongyang because in Asia, the weak leader goes to visit the strong, and President Trump wouldn't want to create that image. He didn't want to go to China or South Korea, where he could be overshadowed by the local leadership. And he couldn't go to Europe because Kim Jong-un wouldn't have a plane to reliably get him there. So he had to go somewhere in Asia that was relatively neutral, and Singapore's a really great choice.
Bruce Bennett is a senior international and defense researcher at the RAND Corporation. In recent days, senior officials from the United States, Canada, and Mexico held a round of talks on the American-North American Free Trade Agreement without any major breakthroughs on how to renegotiate that deal. Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, Chrystia Freeland, was at those meetings and was later asked by reporters if she considered President Trump's message to be threatening, as he linked the idea of exempting countries from trade tariffs with NAFTA renegotiation talks.
The Canadian approach to the NAFTA negotiation has, from the outset, been fact-based. We have approached the table absolutely full with, in a spirit of goodwill, looking for compromise and determined to defend our national interest and looking for creative solutions.
U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer says the United States will continue to work with its partners to update the 1994 trade pact. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say our sun has been shining for about the last 4.5 billion years. The sun is expected to have enough hydrogen fuel in its core to shine for about another 5 billion years. Along with producing solar energy, this nuclear fusion is creating helium. Once the sun runs out of hydrogen, it will start fusing the helium and begin another 5 billion year process that will eventually result in the sun's death. The helium fusion process will cause the sun to expand and transform itself into a red giant star. According to a new study, as the red giant expands, it will lose mass and expel gas and dust, which will form a massive glowing ring called a planetary nebula. The sun will be a white dwarf by then and will eventually die. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. Walk home in my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now, I say a little prayer for you. Forever, forever, you stay in my heart.
Dionne Warwick is an American singer, actress, and television host who became a United Nations Global Ambassador for the Food and Agriculture Organization and a United States Ambassador of Health. She ranks among the 40 biggest hitmakers based on the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles charts. 56 of her singles have made the Billboard Hot 100, and 80 singles making all Billboard's charts combined. Among those super hits was Say a Little Prayer. Born in 1940 in the U.S. city of East Orange, New Jersey, Dionne Warwick burst on the music scene, singing backup vocals for recording sessions in New York City. During one session, Warwick met Burt Bacharach, who hired her to record demos featuring songs written by him and lyricist Hal David. Many of her hits were written by the team of Bacharach and David, songs like Walk On By.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by, walk on by. Make believe that you don't see the tears, just let me grieve in private, 'cause each time I see you, I break down and cry. Walk on by,
stop, stop,
walk on.
Dionne Warwick did lots of duets over the years, including a gigantic hit for her, singing alongside superstars Gladys Knight, Elton John, and Stevie Wonder. That's What Friends Are For was written by Burt Bacharach and Carol Bayer Sager. This recording was released as a charity single for AIDS research and prevention. It was a massive hit, becoming a number one single of 1986. Dionne Warwick was married to William Elliott. They had two sons, David and Damon. She's also related to some of the biggest names in the music business. The sister of Dee Dee Warwick, she was Whitney Houston's first cousin and opera singer Leontine Price's cousin. And still out on the road performing almost all the time.
Keep smiling.
know, truly one of the most amazing duets of all time. And how about Stevie Wonder there on the harmonica? Unbelievable, huh? Fantastic. Hey, listen, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, and we hope you have a great Monday. Now a bit more from Dion and Friends.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador Alexander Lascaris, the Deputy Commander for Civil Military Engagement at United States Africa Command, or AFRICOM, held high-level meetings in Freetown, Sierra Leone, earlier this month as part of a series of engagements across West Africa. During the visit, Ambassador Lascaris, along with the U.S. Ambassador to Sierra Leone, Maria Brewer, met with President Julius Maada Bio to discuss key military, economic, and security-related issues. One topic of particular interest during the meeting was the need for a signed national maritime strategy to guide Sierra Leone's maritime agencies toward secure, sustainable, and profitable seas. The United States, in collaboration with the United Nations Development Program, recently funded a series of events aimed at finalizing a Sierra Leone National Maritime Strategy, a National Maritime Policy, and a framework for a whole-of-government approach to maritime security, which are now awaiting government approval. The participation of Sierra Leone's military in peacekeeping operations precipitated another fruitful discussion. The U.S. ambassadors stressed the need for Sierra Leone to focus on its forces' professional development and welfare in order to prepare peacekeepers that are disciplined, well-trained, and have strong leadership. In speaking with the new Deputy Minister of Defense, Simeon Sheriff, the U.S. delegation also offered to assist Sierra Leone in seeking out sound, economically viable options for training, equipping, and sustaining prospective peacekeeping forces. At the conclusion of his visit, Ambassador Lascaris commented that he was impressed to see how well the democratic process is working in Sierra Leone and congratulated the country for its successful elections and subsequent peaceful transfer of power. The delegation appreciated the opportunity to meet with President Bio and reiterated that the United States looks forward to its continued partnership with the government and people of Sierra Leone.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.